I'm good. I'm good. It's good
can
to
you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh. Yay.
Good to meet you.
It's good to meet you too. Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay. So how does somebody who's so brilliant, because I love your show. I really
thank you.
Adore it. Really love your show. And I love that you are so respectful and just a really good listener, and you bring there's a variety of people on your show, and I really enjoy that.
Thank you.
It's super wonderful to listen to, and it's so varied. I really enjoy that. So how does somebody who has this amazing like podcast personality start off writing basically a spring break giggle and jiggle flick?
Well, there's one person to blame for that, and it's not me.
Is it your dad?
No, it's Brian Schuster, the illustrious producer of the film.
Okay. Okay, so let me grab my questions here real quick. Okay, all right. So I understand that you, just like me, grew up in Florida. So
yes.
What? And you actually grew up in like the epicenter of spring break. So
Miami Beach, yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, my goodness. All right, so tell me a little bit about what that was like.
Okay, well, growing up in Miami Beach was kind of idyllic. In the sense that I didn't know anything else. Like, if you know, I grew up in Miami Beach, it was, you know, a very warm in terms of the atmosphere. My family is very warm family, and so to that extent, humor was just always a part of my experience growing up. That I did get from my dad. My dad was a great storyteller and joke teller. My mom was a great audience. And so, you know, she didn't know how to tell a joke. She was very musical. She had a beautiful singing voice. She went to Manus School of Music in New York. But my dad just had that ear for voices and timing and all that stuff, and he was an attorney, but his love of jokes and his ability to use humor to deflect, you know, kind of diffuse tension and stuff like that. I definitely got that from him. It was a wonderful place to grow up.
That's amazing though. Like, that's so cool that you can kind of look at your parents and you can sort of see where you came from. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like those personality aspects of it is really amazing. How did you start writing screenplays in general?
The first screenplay I wrote, I was 12 years old. The first screenplay, I was 12 years old. And my best friend from childhood, a guy named Michael Grossman, and I wrote together, but I was always the person who wanted to, you know, like you get together with your friends and you do what the other person wants and then you switch and do what they want. And he loved acting out scenes and doing things like that. And, you know, he loved the escapism of it. You know, we would make little cassette tapes that were interview shows. I did that with some other friends of mine as well. But we liked intrigue and drama. So the first script we wrote was not a comedy script or not a frivolous script. It was a heist movie, and it was called Blind Spot, and it was an actual screenplay. Like, it was, I believe, 87 pages. So it was close to the 90 minute mark. But we, you know, came up with the characters and the storyline. And I, you know, and at the time, I think I probably had a word processor or something and wrote this screenplay. I don't know that we ever showed it to anyone, because at that age, you're like, there's no one really to show it to.
Right.
I mean, you know, but for him, it was just fun. And for me, it was like, oh, wow, I want to do more of this. You know, so that was the that was the start. And then I think once I was in college and I was in New York and I was around theater and show business and comedy, I started doing stand-up a little bit. I wanted to write screenplays and make movies. And I had this folder of million-dollar ideas. I had ideas all the time for stories. And I loved writing out the synopses. And again, nobody really saw them. It wasn't anything I could, you know, at that time. But then I did meet an agent, a manager, actually, through one of my college roommates who, you know, I didn't think he would manage me. He wasn't a literary agent, but his wife was for authors. But he managed like Eddie Murphy and James Taylor and Sting and wow, all of that stuff. So it was like almost too high a level thing to, for example, we were at their house in New York City for brunch one Sunday. And I went to use the bathroom and on the couch in the room where the restroom was the script for The Golden Child, which was an Eddie Murphy movie. And he's like, yeah, Eddie wants to know if he should do this movie. He's probably going to do it anyway. I don't know if he should.
Oh my God. That's kind of stuff. Fabulous.
But it at least gave me like a little taste for, oh, it can happen. And I wrote a couple of screenplays one was an action comedy called Dear Life. And the other one was, what was the other one? Oh, it was, I believe, called Come Back Little Devil, which was about, you know, they were very light in, they were not like deep. It wasn't even deep comedy. It was just really fun dialogue and a fun premise and funny characters. That one was that the devil gets tired of all the torture and all the hell that goes on in hell and decides to escape to heaven and take a vacation. And he falls in love and gets found out, you know, as being the devil.
Oh my God. That's brilliant.
Tries to figure out how can the devil fall in love in heaven? So I put these things in a book called the, you know, back then there was no, like, you know, you wouldn't email people scripts. So back then you had to get them published, send them to the Library of Congress.
Yes.
And I put them in the Creative Producers Story Directory, it was called. $50 to put a synopsis in. So I put the two synopses in, and this producer, Brian Schuster, saw it and called me and said, these ideas are really great. I would love to, you know, maybe option one or work with you on something. And he was just super creative and had really great input. It was my first experience with feedback. And and he was producing this movie, and there's a writer named Bill Milling who
yes,
wrote the first draft, who I never met, who wrote the first draft. And Brian was like, can you go in, and we have all the locations are set, the characters are pretty set, although we could add a couple here and there, but they need fleshing out, and we definitely need more humor and more jokes and stuff. So I did a whole rewrite of it, and that was the shooting script, and that was my first screen credit.
Oh my goodness. So it's so funny because we literally have led the same life. Okay.
Oh, like, okay. Well, that's good. Then then we can stop here because you know all the answers.
No, God, but it's like, no, but I'm just saying, like, I wrote my first screenplay when I was 12. I had all my friends, you know, read it and act it out. I did you know, horror movies in high school. That was how, because it's the easiest to shoot, you know.
Sure.
And but very much very light on story and heavy on dialogue.
Right. Right.
Dialogue is my forte, if
Me
you will.
Me too, yeah.
So yeah, it was like snappy back and forth, right? So that, and then the recording your interviews, you know, like your like playing like you're in, you know, a disc jockey or whatever. Like I yeah. did that all the time. And so, yeah, it is just, I completely related to that. So then the idea for Can It Be Love was already kind of solidified. And then they brought you in to just to basically punch up the characters and give it some heart. Cause it's, you know, it's a lot more witty than it has any right to be.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Which I know is you. I know that's you, because Bill Milling has a background in basically beach movies, right?
Right.
He also did Spring Fever USA, which is also known as Lauderdale, Where Life's a Beach. Like
right, they have right.
interchangeable USA Up All Night titles, right? So he kind of covered that stretch, but the heart of these characters and what makes this movie have a cult following, which this is not something that normally I would even cover, you know, but it was a movie that kind of touched me when I saw it, because I was like, oh my God, this is on its surface, right? It's a titty flick,
right.
But the dialogue is so smart and you're really rooting for Tim. You know, yeah. And Dave, you're kind of like, yeah, whatever. But like you want Tim to get the girl, right? You want him to find that magical tattoo in this problematic script. But it's just there's just something about it. There's a lot of heart to it. And I love anything set in Florida, because then I can like look at it and go, oh yeah, that's yes, absolutely. Like yeah, I recognize that, you know. So I think, like I said, it's one of those movies that kind of gets lost in the shuffle, you know, because it doesn't have a DVD release.
Right.
It's super hard to find anybody associated with this movie except for Chuck Klausmeier, who, God bless him, gave me like 2 hours of his time so that we could talk about this movie.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think you did an amazing job with it. I mean, I love it. I absolutely love it. So the film's release date is 1992. That's the street date for it. Did you guys film this in like 89 or see, I didn't really know if it was like early 90s.
No, because I think the turnaround had to be pretty quick.
Okay.
Because my oldest son, my ex-wife was pregnant with with our oldest son. And he was born in February of 92.
Oh,
and so
okay.
She was about 5 months pregnant when we shot the movie. So You do the math.
That's, yeah, right.
that's how I can remember it. Because we got to go to Fort Lauderdale when it was shooting, and I had a small role in it. And
okay. Because I've seen this movie like 20 times.
Oh, well, you didn't know what I looked like, really.
Oh, wait. No. You're not the weird agent on the phone. That's like somebody. First of all, you don't look like that guy. Okay, who?
I was Slick Rick. I was the DJ at
the
Summers.
DJ.
Summers on the Beach.
On the Beach.
Brian had offered me the role of Tim, and I, before they had cast it, I still don't know why I turned it down, although I turned it down thinking, you know, it's not really like it's not what I dream of playing in a movie like this.
Right.
But I was like, you know, I think I was more focused on the writing. I wanted to act and I wanted to be in it. And he's like, okay, well, do a role, like write something for yourself, you know, write something for yourself and come and be in it at least. And I did that. I kind of wrote some that just what I thought was kind of a funny scene, but then we got to go down and be there. And, you know, that was fun.
Oh yeah. I mean, Summers on the Beach was an institution for a very, very long time. That was a huge part of spring break life in Fort Lauderdale. And when that closed down, that's pretty much done with tourism. Well, done with that kind of
jello
tourism.
Dancing continued. Jello
dancing. Jello dancing. I know. Yeah. It's like jello dancing, mud wrestling, wet t-shirt contests, I don't even think are even a thing anymore. I mean, there's a brilliant documentary about the history of spring break in Fort Lauderdale, the history of spring break in South Florida in general. And it talks about how these people, you know, initially were like, oh, this is great. Like, we're getting all of this money and the economy is stimulated and all of these, you know, people are selling things and it's really good for commerce. But then, you know, it also introduced, you know, just rambunctiousness and rape culture and a lot of things that you don't see in these movies, right? Because there's this like handful of spring break movies, right? And it's pretty much just like, guy wants to get laid, guy meets the girl of his dreams, awesome soundtrack, titties, credits, you know?
Right.
So they're really, but they're kind of lighthearted in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there is an innocence there because a lot of it has to do with a guy trying to, you know, have that first time or whatever it is. It's
right.
It's trying to do, they're always trying to do the right thing. And they learn their lesson. They do something, you know, bad or wrong relative to the, you know, the person that they really are. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they learn the lesson.
Yeah. And it's just, that was always interesting. Those were movies that I grew up with. And those were movies that, especially with like USA Up All Night, they were staples. These films were, you know, cut within an inch of their lives and then put on this. So, you know, no nudity whatsoever, but you know, but it's interesting that the culture of that changed. And then eventually people who lived in Fort Lauderdale were like, fuck this. We don't want this here anymore. We will petition to remove it. Then West Palm gets involved and they're like, we're going to be the next Fort Lauderdale. And it's like, no, you're not.
Yeah.
Because you're not Fort Lauderdale, right?
You're not Fort Lauderdale,
So, and I get it. I live on the beach and every year I turn into Richard Crenna from Summer Rental, you know, where I'm just running around going, fucking renters everywhere, renters, you know, and like you people, and I live here and I own property, right? You know, like, no, your parents own property.
Yeah, that's funny.
You don't really, okay, in the script, and I always find this funny, and I talked to Chuck about this, but like I always found it funny that there's this reference in the script in the movie where they're talking and he says, she is the daughter of Steven Strada. And then they're like, the skateboard kid. And like, literally everyone knows what they're talking about except for the people watching the film. So tell me, please, Mr. Screenwriter, what's that based off of?
Just my imagination. Imagination.
That's perfect. I know. Cause Chuck was like, I think you just made it up.
Yeah. It was just made up. I mean, you know, I don't remember whether Bill had possibly put that in before.
I
didn't, you know, if I remember correctly, probably the conversation around it, I wrote, but that premise was not mine. So, but I think I entered it with the idea that there was really nothing real in it anyway.
It is a 100% male fantasy.
It is slightly fantastic.
It's like gorgeous woman Blake Pickett comes into town, transforms nerds, which they're not, right, into, you know, hotter versions of themselves,
right, which
them
that
stay
isn't
at a
hard.
Mansion then right. fucks them both. Then sets them off with basically like carte blanche to go and examine in a variety of ways sorority girls, right, to try to find this you know, rose tattoo. And yeah, and then it's like, you know, but to its credit, the two actors who played those roles owned it. I mean, yes. they weren't for a plot line that is through today's eyes, quite problematic and a little sleazy.
That was the other reason why I didn't do it, was I think my wife at the time didn't love the idea of my playing that character.
Okay.
And doing like it's so funny that she would say at that time, she said, you know, you're not doing any kissing scenes.
And
I was like, well, technically they're fucking scenes, but they're not, you know, it's not, but probably, yeah, there might be some kissing as well.
She told me you were fast asleep.
Right.
I'm like, geez, so, that image, right? Because stuff,
that stuff, you know, if I think about my favorite movies at the time, movies like Pink Panther and stuff that really influenced the humor in that farcical.
Yeah. Very Blake Edwards.
Yeah. Very Blake Edwards. Yeah. Yeah. I love Blake Edwards.
Oh God, me too. Victor Victoria is one of my all time favorite films. I'm a classically trained opera singer and I love the music from that. So
yeah. It was a masterpiece.
Oh God. Absolutely. Okay. So you're a married man at the time.
Yes.
With a baby on the way. I'm guessing just because of your character that you did not hang out on set and party with everybody.
No.
Right.
No. And I honestly, I didn't like, I didn't get like, that wasn't my experience in college anyway. I went to parochial schools my whole life. I went to Hebrew day schools. It was like, you know, I really had a pretty sheltered, you know, experience. College was fun, but it was not like I didn't do spring break really.
Right. Same.
So, yeah. I didn't really do it. So seeing some of the stuff was great. It was kind of fun, you know, to see it. Like, that's why I liked playing that DJ, because the farthest thing from my life would be working at spring break as a DJ. You want to talk about sleazy?
With a like, woman who is immersed in Jell-O.
Yeah.
Naked and in Jell-O. It's like, oh my God. So that's a good question. The women that were in this film, were they pretty much just like, yeah, I mean, we got to make a buck kind of thing?
Or I think, you know, back then we lacked the perspective, certainly as a really young person, lacked the perspective of what the misogynistic attitudes were in Hollywood. Chuck could tell you better what the set was like, you know, what was going on, because I really didn't know. And I was only there for 2 days, but it was like, to me, the fun of filmmaking, it was my first time on a set. Like,
amazing.
And I've now in my career, in the various things that I've done, been on hundreds and hundreds of sets with all kinds of levels of filmmaking and so I really learned, you know, a lot about that medium from those things. But this was just like a real fun kind of little intro into movie making.
Now, how old were you at the time?
Probably 23.
Oh, what a time to be alive. Yes. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Did you maintain friendships with anybody after everybody went their separate ways?
Really just Brian. I mean, I came across people, you know, on other projects that Brian did. And, you know, there was I think at that time, kind of a crew of people like ADs and things like that. But, but Brian and I went on to collaborate on a bunch of stuff. And
yeah, I was actually going to ask you, did you and Brian collaborate on Assault on Dome 4 or The Base? Like,
no.
Those are separate?
Yeah, those were separate. Those came to me through my manager at the time, a woman named Catherine James, who was she had been Tarantino's manager and Roger Avery's manager. And she was phenomenal. What a phenomenal woman she was. And Mark Dacascos had read a script of mine. And Assault on Dome 4 was Brian. Okay. The base was was through Catherine and Mark DeCascos, who had read a script I wrote, a spec called Killer Salesman Hit the Road, which was much more dark and, you know, actiony. And he loved that film, that script. And he introduced me to Mark Lester, the director, and said, you know, I want Hirsch to, you know, write the screenplay for that move for this movie. Wow. And then, but Assault on Dome 4, yeah, that was a collaboration with Brian. And I had written an original script for Brian that was much more original than Assault on Dome 4. It was really more of a character driven space, you know, action movie, but I used devices and things that didn't end up in the final script.
And are those movies available anywhere?
Yeah.
As far as like streaming, they're streaming and stuff. We can like
I think they are. I've seen The Base out there.
Okay.
Assault on Dome 4 was on Sci-Fi Channel and.
Oh, cool. Okay.
You know, so those were, and they made a sequel to The Base. I wasn't involved in it, but they made a sequel.
Now, did you know that this movie has a cult following?
I really didn't until you told me. I know that I know it had gotten some of those nice reviews, like RogerEbert.com, you know, had given it a really nice review and called it, I think, the Where the Boys Are for, you know, for the 90s or.
Wow. That's a pretty big, you know what? That's actually a really, really high compliment to that.
Yes.
Movie.
And so I was flattered by that, but I didn't. So tell me about the cult following. I'm curious.
So I had no idea anyone knew about this movie because when I was growing up and saw it, I had a VHS copy of this thing, right? And I spent a lot of money on it. Like, it was one of those, you know, oh, we can get it off Amazon for $49.99, right? Not only did I have a VHS copy of it, I owned the soundtrack. Because when I would listen, when I watched the movie, I was like, I love this. I need this, right? And I'm very good at being able to find needles in haystacks, you know?
Did you find, Erin, the music video?
Yes.
Because I wrote that music video treatment as well. We shot that while I was down there.
It used to play on Playboy Hot Rocks all the time.
I'm sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because it's a little, it was a little on the racier side, so to speak. But I mean, so does everything in that early 90s. So I became a huge Dillinger fan. And I bought my first like Dillinger CD and off of eBay, you know, because nobody had it, and was like, oh my God. And just absolutely loved it. And I was like, no, they're so it's basically like I have the soundtrack to Can It Be Love, right? You know. And I also remember when the title changed, because I remember watching like pay-per-view or something. Like, it was my parents had a satellite dish, so the stuff was on all the time, and it was no one was paying for it, let's just say that. And it was like Spring Break Sorority Paves, and I was like, that sounds really okay. But then I saw it as Can It Be Love, and so for me I was like, oh, you know, like it's a sweet rom-com sort of spring breaky type movie or whatever. It's not that, right?
Yeah.
So,
and it is more Can It Be Love than Spring Break Sorority Babes, but it's really plenty of Spring Break Sorority Babes.
Oh, absolutely. But I will say, in comparison to Bill Milling's other movie, Lauderdale, Where Life's a Beach, that is just wall to wall tits.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of editing that they had to do to sell to USA Network, I couldn't even imagine.
That's funny. Yeah.
Because it was just one wet t-shirt contest after another. Yeah. Wow. You know, and I mean, it's famous because it's Janine Lindenmulder, who went on to become Janine in the 90s, early Andrew Blake porn times. It was her first movie, period. It was like her, you know, her first mainstream, it wasn't even her first mainstream movie, it was her first movie, right? Yeah. Before she got discovered and went on. But so like, but that even gets lost in the film because the movie is just, it is just a one long, you know, just dirty spring break movie, basically. But whereas Canopy Love, it's interesting, it's easy to follow. I don't feel particularly like I need to take a shower afterwards, a Purell bath. It's genuinely funny and interesting, and I love the soundtrack, and you're like, oh, I really hope Tim gets the girl, you know, like you're real excited.
It really it inspired an entire generation of Purell dancers.
Yeah.
Purell dancing. Because the movie was ultimately, you Ooh. Know, antiseptic, really.
And we should do a show on this because nobody else knows about this. it's just us and the actors. That's it. But I had Chuck doesn't check his messages. Like literally doesn't know how to check his messages.
Okay.
And so he didn't know that he had a message for like 6 months.
Okay.
And so then finally he's like, yeah, he's like, I don't know why I have social media. He's like, I don't use it. I don't check anything. I didn't even know there were messages. Yeah. I mean, and I was like, okay, so, you know, so when he learned about it, he was like, oh, that's great. That's right. Here's my private email, and, you know, and gave me a really great 2-hour interview, and he's amazing, you know, but I couldn't find anyone else.
That's
funny. I mean, oh. I know Blake Pickett became a photographer. Marianne Mixon became I want to say she's a city councilwoman in Miami.
Oh, that makes sense. Huh?
Right. Jennifer Langton gone, face of the earth, you know, completely gone. And no, as far as David's actor, Beaumont, and even Chuck didn't even know. Chuck was like, I have no idea. Right.
Right. Yeah.
And Bill Milling doesn't return emails. So
right. So what happened? So what constituted the cult, the following? What does that mean?
I mean, really, there's a group of people that I have met over time that genuinely find this movie to be endearing.
Oh, well, that's great.
And that's the part of the concept of my show is celebrating that which doesn't get celebrated. There were plenty of podcasts out there that took the piss out of the movies that we review.
Right.
Basically. Right. I mean, some people, that's their whole brand. Right. And I wanted to kind of have a place where people could come and celebrate it and not get ridiculed and not get made fun of and just can come and just be like, yes, I grew up with the pirate movie and I know it's not the best movie in the world, but I have the soundtrack in my car and I had a crush on Christy McNichol and, you know, and Christopher Atkins was this and this, and I grew up with this and I grew up in Australia and this movie's filmed in Australia and that type of thing. And it just became that, like each episode became about finding people that really loved the material, you know, and was like, oh yeah, like Grease 2, Jaws 3, things that people will break their arm to make fun of.
Yeah. And it's easy to make fun of things, you know, it's easy when I looked at those movies in their raw, like in their first draft form and everything, I was like, this is an opportunity for fun dialogue. Like this is an opportunity for smart dialogue. And you can, what I thought was exciting is you could change a character's entire profile through the dialogue without changing the location, without changing the premise, without changing the mission,
yes,
or any of that stuff. You can almost secretly elevate the thing to really where I would just like it. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is my first screen credit. I might as well, I'm not going to be able to change it that much. You know, I'm not going to be able to turn it into one of my movies where I would try to make them you know, take a different turn where you would think that they, where they had done something else in a, in another kind of movie.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. And there's a, there's an interesting scene. It was first, it was of that time period that I actually had respect for, was when Tim says to, oh my God. Okay. I know Jessie is the blonde who strips.
You probably know better than I do.
Yeah. And I can't think of her name. The girl he falls in love with. He says to the girl he falls in love with, he says, oh my God, why would you want to watch something like this? You know? And she's like, that's my roommate. That's Jessie. You know? And which I thought was really interesting, because you didn't see a lot of that. You didn't see, right, a lot of women being like, yeah, you know, sex positive, right? Like, she's,
well, I grew up around a lot of women, so I have, you know, I have two older sisters, and you know, I just, it's like, it just made sense to me. It just was intuitive, you know, at the time.
It's just really, like I said, it just shows, that's why people like it. I really feel like that's why we're talking about Can It Be Love and not Lauderdale.
Right.
Right.
I get it.
Spring Fever, USA. Right. Yeah. It's like, no. All right. So switch gears for a second. How did you start Yes Brand? How did you start podcasting? How did you change gears?
Well, so I was doing stand-up comedy. I was writing the screenplays. I always had divided my life into two boxes. So I had the screenwriting and acting and comedy box, and I had the advertising box. And the way the advertising box even came to be was that I was going to school of visual arts. I was studying screenwriting, filmmaking, you know, going out shooting movies in on Super 8 and all that stuff. And then the chairman of School of Visual Arts, George McGinnis, his name was, said to me, you know, you should study advertising. You're in New York, you're right here on Madison Avenue. He said, whether you want to be like a copywriter or want to be a producer, you have a great sales instinct, like for advertising. You could sell a line on a piece of paper, he said, was what I remember him saying. And he said, you should take this course in commercial production. And because I knew I was doing a lot of things that could possibly take a long time to really pay off, and you know, you don't want to sit writing screenplays all day long and nobody sees them or whatever,
right,
I took the class, and I didn't even think anything of it. I enjoyed the class, but I didn't feel like a producer at all. And then I got a call. A friend of mine said she was a rep. She was working for somebody who repped art directors for commercials. Wow. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, an agent. And she's like, yeah, I'm like an agent for art directors, or I work for an agent. We were kids, you know, like still in my early 20s. And so I went to work for a guy named Carl Forsberg, who's still a dear, dear friend of mine, a great mentor. And he repped commercial directors. And what I found interesting and exciting about that was, because being an agent, if I went to work in the mailroom at William Morris, I wouldn't meet anybody.
And right,
if I did, it would be just to get them coffee, you know?
Right.
Whereas in the commercial production world, reps were like directors of TV commercials were superstars. And we were their emissary to the world. So they want to direct a certain kind of thing. We're really like their agent. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, now I can be on sets of, you know, Super Bowl commercials. And one of our directors was a guy named Peter Nigrel, who was a brilliant visual filmmaker. And he was doing a music video for If I Could Change the World from the John Travolta movie.
The Eric Clapton.
Yeah. What was the movie called?
Phenomena.
Thank you. So he was about to direct the music video, and he said, Hirsch, do you have any ideas for the music video? And it was Eric Clapton and Babyface or whatever. And I honestly didn't, but he said, you know, come to the set, whatever. So I go to the set, and I walk into Bergen Station in New Jersey, and it's this big train station.
Oh my goodness.
And I hear Layla, acoustic version of Layla playing. And I go, oh, that's cool. It must be playing like on the sound system or something. And I look to my right and Eric Clapton is sitting on this bench playing Layla, the acoustic version of Layla.
Oh my God.
And, you know, I was like shocked that I was that close to somebody of this caliber, and had lunch with them there. And like, it was the vibe of what I was doing there was great. And I could tell directors what my ideas were. I made some short films with some really wonderful directors. But at the same time, always gnawed at me that I wasn't writing movies there. I was just on the periphery creatively. I ended up being like starting what became an industry of publicity for that market. And so I had a company called Raging Artists, and it was, you know, I had one called Juice with a partner, and they were like the predominant or preeminent, you know, PR firms in that industry.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I liked writing. And as I did this parallel kind of not career, but sideline in screenwriting and in acting and, you know, stand up mostly, I started to develop myself as a creative, as a copywriter. And eventually Yes Brand became like a way to, you know, infuse the humor and humanity that I brought to my writing, even as early as, you know, Canopy Love, and start to combine that with brands and branding. And so Yes Brand is like a spin on the Yes And rule of improv. And the idea being that you just always accept the offer from your scene partner or your collaborator, or in my case, the brand, and you build on it. You build the story together. And that's what I do with brands.
That's so brilliant. I love that. That's just amazing. Like, you've maintained your creativity over that period of time. And that's pretty awesome. And also, like, I've listened to a few of the shows. It's really brilliant. Like, I love the one you had done most recently. It was like two episodes ago. The gentleman who is the former drug dealer.
Oh yeah. Damon.
Damon. Yes. Damon, oh my goodness. No, I love it because I have 15 years sober. And I'm in recovery. So I completely related to it. I was just like, oh yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. And he's a really amazing guy. The sister podcast is the Truth Tastes Funny podcast, which is about things like that, crazy things, like turns that life takes and all that stuff. Yes Brand, you know, always circles back to the brand. But they're two sides of the same coin. And I release one of those shows every week.
As somebody who battles mental illness, and part of why we call our show Manic Movie Monday is because I'm a manic depressive. So that was where it came from. And, you know, yeah, sometimes I'll listen to certain episodes and I'll be like, yeah, we both sound manic. And then one of us is actually manic depressive.
Well, that's where humor comes in. It's like, without humor, I don't know how any of us would deal with any of life's, you know, crazy challenges, much less the pandemic and all the other upheaval and all that stuff.
You have to have it. I mean, I didn't even start listening to podcasts until the pandemic, until we were in lockdown in Florida. And, you know, and then I got cut from work for the summer because I was a temp, and they were like, we don't have any work for you.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of time on my hands.
Yeah.
And so I listened to a ton of podcasts and got introduced that way, and really studied the craft of it before somebody said, you know, hey, you have this bizarre encyclopedic knowledge of cult films, horror films, stuff from the 80s. You know, you should probably do a podcast. And I was like, yeah, you know, and then one day I was feeling particularly manic and I said, we should do a podcast.
Right. Right.
Right. Yeah. I was like, I'm going to buy a mic.
Well, similar with Truth Tastes Funny, because I did feel like, well, if I have anything to offer now, it's at this moment in time, it's the ability to diffuse, you know, stress, sadness, whatever it might be. Yeah, we are similar in that I always say I have, my mind is a repository for arcane, useless information. It's like, I'll know all these trivia things, and it's so not, it's not important. And the older you get, the harder it is to recall very simple things.
Oh yeah. Like what you ate yesterday.
Started.
Yeah.
Like, has this interview started yet? Or is it no, or it did. We're here.
Right.
So like, it's like, I can remember, you know, something from,
oh yeah,
Miami.
Oh, absolutely.
Miami Vice.
Right. Yes. Oh, I'm a huge Miami Vice fan. I absolutely, I've got two Miami Vice shirts right in that dresser over there.
Well, Erin, that was the first set that I actually was on, was Miami Vice, because my cousin was the chiropractor on the set.
Oh my God.
He brought me to the set, you know, one day they were in our neighborhood and he said, come over to the set. And so that was the first set that I was on.
Oh, my heart. Yeah. I got into it literally this year. Like I was sitting there going,
that's
like,
crazy.
You know, because I'm a huge music person. And so I started, it was one of those things where you have a Spotify playlist and then it ends and Spotify goes, what about this?
Yeah.
And they played Crockett's theme. Right.
Right.
And I was like, what is
I have to make a note to myself to get the, Miami Vice on my Spotify. That, I mean, Hans Zimmer and, you know, and the Phil Collins, you know, in the air tonight. And
it was beautiful.
It was transformative.
Oh yeah. My goodness. Oh, absolutely. And so I was immediate. I was like, okay, I talked to a friend of mine and I said, listen, I need you to upload all of the Miami Vice episodes. I'm going to watch them. And he was like, okay.
Wow.
So I started watching it and just the incorporation of the music in the scenes and the colors.
The color,
and,
I was going to say.
Oh, colors. God.
And, Michael Mann's a genius.
Oh, my God. I love him incredible. So much. And the cinematography of it. And then everything all at once, right? I was hooked.
Yeah.
Hooked. Completely hooked. And yeah. And then so then I made my own Miami Vice, you know, playlist. And I played that every single day at work until I was done with it.
Yeah.
But I will tell you, Crockett's theme is still in my night mix. So when I sleep at night, I put music on and it just does in a loop. And that is one
of
my.
Oh, I should try that. The hell was it called? Smuggler's Cove?
Oh, of course. Smuggler's Blues?
Smuggler's Blues. Glenn Frey. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It was so cool. So yeah, I saw how it was incorporated into the show, I was like, this is absolute brilliance. Like, this is so brilliant. And I'm a huge Manhunter fan. And so when they had the one episode where it was like the guy that was breaking into the houses and then putting the powder all over his face, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, dude, this is Manhunter. Like, this is totally the Manhunter.
Right,
like, this is what happened when, you know, Francis Telluride, you know, see, right? Like, out of my mouth.
There
like,
you go.
Like,
well, it's the same thing with, like, Smuggler's Blues and, like, you know. Ooh, like, I was going to try to remember. I thought I would remember the name of Phil Collins' character
on
Miami Vice. It's something like.
Yeah.
Like. Stan the Sham or Sam the Sham or something like that. We'll find out. But
yeah, I think it's
another
it's something like that. Yeah.
You know, we'll what did we do before Google? It was like
right?
I have to do it. That's how compulsive.
Because growing up, I was like that kid that just memorized the TV guide, you know, and that was a thing that like my parents could ask me like, okay, what's on tonight? And I would just rattle it off like in some savantian way.
Right? Yeah, right.
So I get it, man. I mean.
Oh, Jan Hammer. I said Hans Zimmer, I think. It's Jan Hammer that did the score.
Yeah. Oh,
correction.
So amazing.
Fill
so
the shill. So
Phil the Show.
It was, and I said Sam the Sham, but okay.
And I'm watching it, and I'm like, it was funny because I would see the same house, right? And I'd be like,
yes,
isn't that the house where they kept the girl at the, you know, and then I'd be like, oh, okay, they're just recycling the same.
It was fun to, well, what they did was they created mansion facades. You know, Miami Beach was a shithole kind of at that
time. Yeah.
In terms of South Beach. Like my grandfather lived on South Beach. We would go to South Beach, my sisters and I, like to go to dive bars and stuff and whatever. I was probably 16 or something, but it's like, who cared? Nobody would even, but we would go to like these dive bars. Then slowly they started like doing these facades. And then the hotels were like, well, we should just fix this shit up and make this make this look nice. And then all of a sudden the Edison Hotel and whatever hotels they were, they redid them and they made them South Beach like it was in the show, and it became real.
Just fascinating. I will watch those episodes and I will just and you're like transformed. I mean, just like you'll hear, you know, like Billy Idol's, you know, Flesh for Fantasy, right? And you'll just be like, oh, you know, like, or I made a meme one time and it said, this must be the episode where, this must be the episode where Sunny falls for the wrong woman.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, damn it, I've seen this one.
Right.
Or like, oh, this is the, oh, this God. Is the
episode where Gina pretends to be a prostitute.
Oh, God. And has to have sex with Polly from Rocky.
Oh, my God. Burt Young.
Oh my God. Right.
This it's is like, a fun game.
Horrifying.
Well, was
horrifying.
That the character's name, Gina? I just threw that.
Gina. Yeah.
So I pulled that out of my ass too. Yeah.
You did, but you pulled it out. It was perfect. Yes. Yeah. It's like she gets to play a prostitute twice. Once she actually has to have sex with Burt Young, she takes one for the team and nobody's like, you know, maybe you should go to a therapist.
Yeah. Nobody thinks it's inappropriate or, you know.
Crockett's like, hey, I'll meet you on my boat later.
Yeah.
Like, I'll take care of it. Right. Like just, and then, I mean,
that's going to cure it. What's going to cure it is that, that after having sex with Burt Young, you have sex with Don Johnson and that makes it all better.
It makes it all better. Right. Yeah. All better. I know they just interviewed Don Johnson. He's like in his 70s. Right. Yeah. And he's like, they're like, well, have you slowed down in your later years, you know, like your sex drive and whatever? He's like, I love sex. I will fuck all the time. I have it down to a science.
Like, yeah, I don't know if that's a good thing. I don't know.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Seems, I thought to myself, he's
nicer
like,
now. He seems still, a little nicer now. So
he's still Crockett.
He's still yeah.
And I also find it really funny that Philip Michael Thomas coined the phrase EGOT and never got any of the E or the G or the O.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? No. Yeah. He came up with it and was like, I, Philip Michael Thomas, am going to be an EGOT winner.
All right. Well, I'm going to stop it, Aaron, because I don't have room for that. I can't fit that in now.
I'm
there's
sorry.
No room for new info. I can't put new info in there.
No, that's it. Terrible. That's exactly how I am. Well, oh my God, Hirsch, this has been an honor. And
thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome. You're amazing. You're
likewise. This is so much fun.
You just have been so wonderful. And thank you so much for giving me your time and for answering my questions.
Did we get through all your questions?
Yes, you did. Okay, totally. You totally did. And I will keep listening to your show and telling people about it because it really is. It's so amazing. I love that you have this variety of people on there to talk about their lives and where their lives have taken them. It's amazing. So,
and I will do the same for Manic Movie Monday.
Thank you. And, that's very sweet. We're surprised when anyone listens. Like Hillary, my co-host, she's like, she'll say it. She'll be like, we have fans. Like,
well, like, we all have fans. We all have fans. And we should appreciate the fans that we have, even though we probably don't know about a lot of them. And that's in life, not just in broadcasting. A lot of times you just don't know. You don't know whose life you might have affected or
absolutely
who is a fan of yours. And you know, we get wrapped up in our own head.
And yeah, absolutely. And so obviously any of our listeners can find you on anywhere you find podcasts, correct?
That's right. Yes. That's right. If they go, if they look up, you know, yesbrandmethod.com or truthtastesfunny.com or my name, you know, hirschreplin.com, they'll find all this stuff. Yeah, but we're on all the platforms.
Fantastic. Okay. And of course, I realized that you are recording. I am not.
Well, this has been so much fun, Erin. You are wonderful and delightful. So thank you for including me in this afterlife of what's it called? Can It Be Love?
Can It Be Love? I know. Miami Vice.
Yeah.
All these things we're talking about. Oh, God. Have a great rest of your day, please.
You too. I'll talk soon.
See you soon. Bye.